WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Shadow of the Vampire, starring Willem Dafoe and John Malkovich, is a film inspired by the making of the 1922 German film Nosferatu. It's scheduled to be released in December, but audiences got a preview last spring at the Cannes Film Festival. This was also the occasion for an onstage conversation between Dafoe and film critic Roger Ebert as part of the American Pavilion's Industry in Focus series. We have an excerpt of their conversation to share with you today. Dafoe has appeared in such films as Platoon, Streets of Fire, To Live and Die in L.A., The Last Temptation of Christ, The English Patient, and American Psycho. Roger Ebert is the film critic for the Chicago Sun-Times and hosts Ebert and Roper at the Movies. Nosferatu, F.W. Murnau's black-and-white silent film, was the original Dracula classic. It starred the German actor Max Schreck in a ghoulish, highly stylized portrayal of the vampire. In the upcoming film Shadow of the Vampire, Willem Dafoe plays Max Schreck. Here's Roger Ebert.
Everybody at this festival is talking about your work as Max Schreck, the Nosferatu, and it's just an amazing performance, and it's certainly on my list of the top two or three performances. I want to start maybe with the exterior and then kind of work into the interior. You disappear. You're not there on the screen. It's not makeup either. I'm not aware of makeup. I'm not aware of whatever you're doing, which is good because I don't want to be. I'm very familiar with the Murnau film, and I simply see someone who could have been in the Murnau film without a single atom being different.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about your technical or physical preparation?
Well, it's such a literal mask. It's such a strong mask. Even in a conventional movie, sometimes I seek out a mask because it frees me up. Mm-hmm. It lets go of my ego agenda. It makes me feel like someone else. It invites different impulses than I have normally and kind of puts you in a place where you can pretend better. This was so extreme, and I had such a great model with the Max Schreck role. It started with mimicry, really. And I couldn't really do any work until I couldn't begin my work except for maybe some superficial reading on Murnau and the period, and of course seeing Murnau's films. The work really started once I got in the makeup, in the costume, because it was so restricting. As you say, I looked in the mirror and I wasn't there anymore. So who was? Max Schreck. It's like a fast track to pretending. I didn't feel myself so much anymore. It's a wonderful help. It's a good setup.
And who was Max Schreck, in your opinion? Because he will be forever known, despite the fact that he led a full life, as the Nosferatu.
Max
his image will always be remembered exactly as it was in that film.
A perfect case of his success really destroying him, because apparently he didn't work much after that because he couldn't be disassociated from that role. I didn't feel the need so much to know who Max Schreck was. I was more concerned with using his performance in the Nosferatu as a model. And then the other parts of our film that are invention just really came out of, the situation and trying to inhabit that mask. It's funny. I mean, I saw the film last night with an audience, and I had seen it once before. And when I watched, I was asking myself some of these questions, and I can't remember, quite frankly. It's a very strong script, and you play the scenes just like you'd play any of those scenes. I don't remember. I see all this eye rolling and all this kind of extreme gestural language. I honestly can't say I analyzed that or intended that. It was just a natural kind of a natural outgrowth of playing the scenes, as you would almost conventionally. But you've got this wonderful filter that you're playing it through, and that allows you you're forced into a different language, to find in a different language, and part of that language is eye-rolling and clicking your fingernails. Those aren't ideas, they come out of necessity. The first time you're at lunch and you reach for the salt and your nails go like that, then you go like this, you hear the click, and then you simply find it useful in the scene to express yourself. So,
you have really developed a filmography of worked with some of the best directors that we have, from Scorsese to Oliver Stone, to Alan Parker, to Paul Schrader. These are the best, the most interesting directors in America, and there could be others, of course. What is your relationship as an actor to strong directors like this, auteurs, if we can use that word here at Cannes?
Picking projects, it has so much to do with the director. I feel comfortable with directors that write their own material or are very strong personalities. I think that's partly because, as an actor, I feel most comfortable if I'm serving someone's agenda. If they're passionate, I attach myself to their passion. Now, if you attach yourself to someone else, and you're like their agent, you're their doer, you're the person that does what they can't do because they're behind the camera, it really frees you up.
There's also a certain amount of modesty to that approach.
Just like all actors, I've got that, look at me, look at me, look at me, don't look at me. Now, some actors don't have that, don't look at me, but I have it deeply, I do. So in order to say, look at me, look at me, look at me, for that not to be a humiliation and feel like just a egotistic exercise, I get to say, don't look at me because I want to be here, look at me because we're talking about something else. You know what I mean? It's freeing. It may be a trick, it may be totally a device, but that doesn't matter. I just feel like, you know, you get much closer to things being practical, you stay away from a certain kind of pretentiousness and a certain kind of narcissism, and allows you to transform yourself.
Yeah. You know, what you just said helps me to understand why I admired The Last Temptation of Christ so much. Here is a role, I mean, if there was ever a look at me role, it's Jesus Christ. And if there is ever a role that gives an actor more license than perhaps the actor needs, it's playing Jesus. And that particular film was a deeply spiritual film, but it wasn't a religious film, it wasn't a biblical film. It struck me as being extremely oriented in the man and his experiences without the myth of Jesus, the image of Jesus, or the ego of Jesus, who, after all, can be excused for having a large ego. What you've just said about acting helps to explain, first of all, we know Scorsese is obsessed with the Catholic view anyway, but it explains why you were so grounded there. You were never, most people who play Jesus just take off and never land until the final credits.
I think that's a good observation. I really do, and that's why that movie was very important to me, because that, you know, when I'm saying this stuff, I'm always talking about degrees. Your job is different every time. You're always reinventing your process. But that's a perfect example of that giving over. Some people mistake it for passivity or lack of passion. It's just the opposite. But that was a very reactive role, and I could only give myself over to it if I didn't have a certain kind of agenda or expectation. And because of how the role was built, I think it worked well. It worked well.
On the other hand, in Platoon, which was your first, you'd been acting for 6 years, I believe, at that time, but it was the film that everybody walking out of that film knew who you were. In that one, you were really in it up to your armpits. And yet, at the same time, very much in terms of the daily experience of being a combat infantryman in Vietnam, not being... I never got the feeling that you were the hero of a war movie.
Right.
Or a protagonist of a war movie.
Right. Well, I think the strength of that was, even though it's basically melodrama, it was so rooted in the details of the doing. The tasks for an actor in that movie were very concrete. That's a different kind of mask. You know, you don't deal with egotism there either, because you're doing very specific things. And that gets you away from yourself. And when you get away from yourself, I think it allows you to empathize with someone that isn't you and makes you able to take greater leaps as far as choices and how you play scenes. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you approach a scene and you know too well what has to be accomplished mm-hmm. sometimes. I mean, I'm making a case for a little beginner's mind, you know, here.
When I saw that picture, that's it.
Little canned aggression.
They go to a frenzy. There are behind that wall are all kinds of people who want to be directors and are currently making sandwiches as fast as they can, which I think is excellent training for any director. When I think about Platoon, you know, most movies about war carry with them baggage of millions of war movies, and I think centrally the image of John Wayne or Robert Mitchum or somebody like that, one of the heroes of the 40s. Platoon was about highly skilled technicians going to work every day and doing a really rotten and difficult job. And I found that your performance and the movie in general was not a war movie in the genre sense.
Mm-hmm.
It was
mm-hmm.
a very particular story about a work experience.
Wow.
You know, rarely, there aren't often movies about people who have a job. They had a job.
That's interesting. You know, much is made of our training to make that movie, but it was essential. And what rooted that movie constantly was we were doing soldierly things. So I relate to what you say there.
Willem Dafoe speaking with Roger Ebert at the Cannes Film Festival. Let's hear a scene from Dafoe's 1986 Vietnam film, Platoon. Dafoe is talking with a young Marine played by Charlie Sheen. They're discussing Dafoe's rivalry with another sergeant.
Barnes has got it in for you, doesn't he?
Barnes believes in what he's doing.
And you? You believe?
65? Yeah. Now? No. What happened today is just the beginning. We're gonna lose this war.
Come on. You really think so? Us?
We've been kicking other people's asses for so long, I figure it's time we got ours kicked.
We'll continue our conversation with Willem Dafoe and Roger Ebert in a moment. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring an excerpt of a conversation between Willem Dafoe and film critic Roger Ebert, recorded at this year's Cannes Film Festival.
One of your favorite pictures of mine is Light Sleeper.
Good for you.
Which is
we're going to be great friends.
Yes,
you're naming,
we are.
You're talking about all the right stuff.
I knew I would be very comfortable talking to you.
Good, I'm glad
Paul
you
Schrader
like that.
Picture. And I was talking to Schrader a couple of years ago. I see him from time to time, and as you probably know, because you know him much better than I do, he's a person who often announces, this will be my last film. I will never be hired again. This will be my last chance to work. I'm obsolete. Hollywood is moving away from what I do, and so forth. And most recently, he had codified this. Excuse me, the pubic hair comes in next week. When you get 4 hours of sleep, your voice is the first thing to go. He had codified this. He said, I am an existentialist who grew up in the 70s when we had existential films, and I am now trying to survive in an ironic age when every film has quotation marks around it. I think of you as, I think those are two categories that are very limiting, but if I had to choose one of them for you, it would be existential and not ironic. In other words, I think you are much more at home in characters who are absolutely who they seem to be than characters who are inviting the audience to wink.
I think that's true. I think that's very true. I'm not a very ironic person. It's a shame because I find irony charming, but that's, you're
but
right
you seem
on.
But you seem to be attracted to
to movies and to stories and to characters that who are really engaged with whatever terrific problems their life presents to them. Light Sleeper is an example of that.
I love moral crises. Uh-huh. I love the heroism of people, even when they fail when they have these crises. I think that's even the most depressing. What exhilarates me about movies is always when I find myself. Oh God, 4 hours of sleep.
Did you get 4 too?
Yeah.
I was at the Darren Aronofsky film until 2:30. Got to bed at 3. Got up at 7 to go to the 8:30 screening. This is kind of a, you know, when you get tired enough, you tell the truth. I think they demonstrated with Prisoners
of
War.
That's true. No, I know what I was going to say, but I was going to, you know, you get in the middle of this, of talking about something sometimes, and after you've been talking straight for 2 days, you get in the middle sometimes and you say, do I really want to complete this thought?
Yeah.
That's where I'm at, what I just did. So, forgive me, but...
Well, I don't really imagine that your favorite thing is doing publicity for movies.
It's not bad. It's not bad. I mean, I try to use it to see how I feel. And if the people aren't jerks, it can be fun. And I am an actor, you know, we do like attention. What happens sometimes is after a full day of doing this, you kind of get seduced into people thinking, I mean, well, you're an exception here, but people really thinking, you start to think people really want to know what you think. Mm-hmm. And they don't, because it's really, for the most part, for this kind of publicity that I'm usually doing, because it's really just a convention. It's a publicity arm. And what you do is you start to get loose, and then you start to talk, and you start to confess, and you start to really find the truth. And by the end of the day, sometimes you feel raped because you've kind of exposed yourself, and then realized that you weren't sure what it was for. And what made you expose yourself was you were seduced by this attention. And I think that's hard.
When I started out as a film critic and did interviews, I didn't have any clout. Nobody had heard of me. I was from Chicago, which, you know, and so forth and so on. Yet, when you did an interview, it would be like Lee Marvin would say, come out to the beach and we'll get drunk.
Uh-huh.
Or Robert Mitchum, you would be in the backseat of his car as he drove around Pittsburgh smoking pot and getting lost on his way to a location. We were in McKeesport, Pennsylvania, bribing a snowplow operator to lead us back across the bridge to Pittsburgh. I mean, I'll never forget that day. Today, it's the 3-minute hotel room soundbite. Now, I know that actors are put on an assembly line in order to provide the greatest amount of publicity bang for the buck, and I understand that. But for the actor, it must be extremely odd to know that in a way it's just a take, and then it's cut, and then the next person comes in. And it would almost be, it would seem to be freer if there were fewer rules. Do you sometimes feel as if the publicity machine limits your ability to be who you are or to feel like you are in the publicity situation like here at Cannes?
Sure, particularly with like television, with sound bites you mm-hmm. feel. I don't think anecdotally, and I admire people that do. You know, sometimes I watch these trashy entertainment shows and a guy will get up there, you know, he'll be at an opening and he'll say something really quick, concise, and clever, you know? And I think, damn, I wish I could do that. You know, it's not particularly thoughtful, but it makes good entertainment. So I always feel conflicted when that's my job, to essentially do that, and I'm really ill-suited for it.
Do you find sometimes that when you're talking about your movies with people, they seem to feel that when you signed up for the project, you knew that the movie was going to be exactly the way it was?
Sure.
Why did you make this movie?
Sure.
Which your answer might be, I don't even know why the director made this movie, but the movie that I read the screenplay for, I know why I made that.
It's true.
I mean, they give you credit for having complete foresight of everything that's going
to
happen.
It's true. And when I approach a movie, I always try to be able to say there's one reason I absolutely know why I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of it's intuitive. So even then, if the movie's a failure, I can live with myself. Because the tricky part is, I mean, what you're alluding to is, you know, you're in the mix, and even if you have a lot of power in the movie, so many things can go south. There's so many variations, and for an actor in particularly, what you do is mediated by so many hands, for better and for worse, that it's always a little scary. I think the hardest thing to do, I'm you know, privately pleased when a critic like you says that I've made good choices. It's so hard, so difficult to make good choices.
Willem Dafoe speaking with film critic Roger Ebert. Their conversation was taped at the American Pavilion at this year's Cannes Film Festival. Dafoe's upcoming film, Shadow of the Vampire, will be released in December. Coming up, a review of a new recording by jazz musician Marty Ehrlich. This is Fresh Air.